Shall we start? This is going to be much more intime this time because of the change of date. Obviously, a smaller audience than usual, so we could have more banter, really. You remember last time I tried the experiment of answering questions? I didn't really think it worked all that well with a big audience, but someone suggested to me that I could do the same thing answering questions by email. So, well, I think it's quite a good idea. I got two good questions here by email from Stephen Shepherd. I don't know if Stephen Shepherd is here, but they're good questions. So if I manage the paper, I think I'll just try and pose them and answer them. There are two basic questions that he sent down the email system. I could have answered them by email, I suppose, but anyway. The first is quite an interesting one. I made this point in a couple of lectures ago. Who will speak for the oppressed now? Now that Marxism seems to have collapsed and socialism more generally seems to collapse, who will hear the sigh of the oppressed creature? Who will provide the heart of a heartless world? And he asks me here, he says, this is an interesting question, but this seems to preserve the religious component of Marxism. And I was specifically, he points out, criticizing the idea that Marxism is a sort of surrogate religion. I don't think in making this comment I was introducing the idea, reintroducing the idea that Marxism is a form of religion. What I meant by it is that we seem to live in a world now where there is an enormous gap between an accelerating global market society and the ethical implications of social justice and living a humane form of life. I don't therefore see this myself as primarily a religious question. I see it as an ethical question. But I also see it as a prime sociological, economic, and political question. How do we defend notions of social justice effectively in the context of an increasingly market society? Because a market society might be economically efficient, but does not in and of itself carry criteria of social justice. That is not in the nature, I think, of markets. You might argue there are certain democratizing possibilities which markets tend to enhance, but there is an obvious gap between a market-based, not just economy, but society, and the demand for an ethical way of life. I think this is a very important gap to try to address. And with the collapse of Marxism and socialism, it's not easy to see what a rational response would be to that. There are lots of other implications of this that I hope to discuss subsequently in these lectures. Second point is also, I think, interesting, because you remember I was saying that we seem to live in a world where history no longer necessarily provides the solutions to the problems which history has generated. And I suggested this is, if you use the terms of the German sociologist Ulrich Beck, this is a risk society, not a society where we can be sure that human beings can solve their problems, or that we can solve our own problems we've created through history in the way which Marx anticipated. And the question is there really any difference between the problems we face now, the ones I mentioned, AIDS, BSE, global warming, impact of information technology, and so on, and examples like the Irish potato famine in the 19th century? What is the difference? My argument about this wasn't really based on specifying a difference, and I'd like to emphasize that because I think the question is an interesting one. What I was arguing was that we live in a period dominated by the Enlightenment, dominated by modernity, dominated by a certain interpretation of history, and even if you like time, which stems from the Enlightenment of modernity. You could describe this as what I sometimes call a providential view of the world. Providential view of the world suggests precisely that history does create its own solutions, that in the end things will turn out for the best. I think most of those who first of all stress the significance of the beneficial effects of science and technology for us and the dominant trends of development of enlightenment did stress providentialism. I mean, you could say providentialism possibly has Christian roots, because there are a strong streak of providentialism in Christianity too, but whether it does or not, I think this is characteristic of our outlook on the world. In the end, solutions are possible and they will come along. I don't think we any longer live in a world where we can simply sustain at least an easy providentialism, especially when it's geared to science and technology and the main motors of economic growth that we have today. So I mean our attitude towards the world has to be altered. So I'm not saying the world is a more risky place than it used to be. I'm not saying that there weren't humanly created disasters in the past, because of course there have been many partly humanly created or wholly created disasters. But we live in a world, I think, where we anticipated precisely that we could control such disasters and that things like, for example, the potato famine would become rarer and rarer, which indeed I think you could say they have done. But at the same time as our increasing reliance on science and technology has allowed us to solve certain types of problems or produce an approach to them, they've created a much more complex tangle of problems embroiled in the very advance of scientific and technological and other forms of knowledge themselves. It's this tangle which I want to use this lecture series to try to unravel, or at least to take a position in relation to. So I'll come back to some of these issues anyway again later in the lectures, but thanks very much in the interim for the questions. Now, if you consider what's going on in social science today, one of the most interesting and provocative statements recently about where the world is going in the wake of the collapse of communism was produced by the American political scientist Samuel Huntington. I'm sure some people will know of this. Samuel Huntington, who talks of the clash of civilizations. What Huntington suggests, put rather primitively for purposes of time, is that with the collapse of the bipolar system, with the disintegration of communism, with the dissolution of Marxism, the main struggles which are starting to characterize our world and which are likely to dominate the world for the next several decades are bound up with religion and with the ethics of different civilizations, the different ways of life of different civilizations. Huntington sees a number of massive fault lines opening up across the world, separating, for example, Islam, we were just talking about before the lecture on Christianity, but also separating off certain other major types of civilization in the world, which Huntington sees as involved, I think what you could say is a struggle for survival. Until 1989, you had communism versus capitalism, put it crudely. That was a kind of stabilizing influence on the world, because the Cold War world was very threatening, but it had a sort of stability to it. With the dissolution of this system, Huntington and others argue, we now see a new period likely to be dominated by a struggle of civilizations to either defend their position or to assert primacy over other civilizations. Very different view of the world from that suggested by Marx and Marxism, I think. Now, with due recognition of important differences, this is exactly the view of the world, Huntington's view of the world is exactly the view of the world associated with a second intellectual tradition in the social sciences, I now want to move on to look at the second version of what modernity is all about, that associated with the writings of Max Weber. Max Weber had exactly this view of history, and I think would have been not at all surprised to see books like Huntington's being published. Max Weber lived from 1864 to 1920. Weber's view of history, at least in my interpretation of it, was totally different from that of Marx. Marx was a thinker who felt, just as I was saying in response to the question just now, that history has a progressive form. And that progressive form can be linked to the increasing world dominance of the modern West. Marx had very little time, really, for traditional civilizations. Marx did not see the world as a struggle of civilizations. He absolutely did not see the world in that way. Marx saw the world as the continual progression of human reason, where that human reason reached its epitome, its apogee so far, in the triumph of the modern Western way of looking at things and the modern Western way of stimulating the production of economic wealth. If you look at what Marx had to say about India, for example, Marx was not a defender of traditional Indian civilization. Rather, he saw it as a barrier to the development of what he wanted to see, a sort of unified world moving towards unified communism or unified socialism. Marx, therefore, I think, for all his cosmopolitan outlook, still belonged to a generation like that of Montesquieu and others before, who saw the Eastern civilizations as essentially reactionary and saw the West as progressive. The history of the world, for both Marx and Hegel, I think, was linked into the progressive ascendancy of reason, and reason was taken to be epitomized above all by Enlightenment modernity. Enlightenment modernity, if you decode that, meant the progressive task which modern Western civilization is taking on for humanity. Marx saw this as a universalizing feature of the role of the West. Of course, he recognized that the West was linked to colonialism, that it was highly destructive and so forth, but at the same time, he saw it as embodying progressive reason of history. Max Weber comes from a completely different starting point. And in some ways, many people would say this is more relevant to our experience now and to the kind of world that Huntington is trying to describe, because Max Weber argued that history has no form, history has no shape. For Weber, you cannot trace out, or you cannot, let me put it this way, you cannot subordinate history to a single scheme of analysis. History does not have a single linear form. There is no progressive emancipation of humanity linked to historical change, in Weber's view. History is chaos. History is, in a certain sense, non-linear, Weber thought. History, insofar as history has form and shape, according to Weber, it emerges precisely through the struggle of different civilizations, different ways of life, which seek to impose themselves upon one another. Max Weber was strongly influenced by Marx in certain ways, in ways I'll mention a bit later. But he was also the first major European thinker to be influenced by Nietzsche, by Friedrich Nietzsche, and picked up from Nietzsche the idea that, as both of them put it, there are different warring gods. The gods are always at war with one another. The differing warring gods are not individual gods, they are the different ethical outlooks of different civilizations and cultural groupings in history. For Weber, quite different from Marx, there is no rational way in which you can say the kind of society produced by the West is ethically superior to any other kind of civilization or cultural claim. For Weber, there is no way in which you can rationally defend the ethical position of one civilization over others. If the West has turned out in our time to be a globally dominant civilization, according to Weber, this is largely the result of power, and for Weber, the theme of power is absolutely fundamental to his interpretation of history. The West has come to dominate world history, at least for a while, because of the power which it has generated, which has allowed it militarily and economically to crush other civilizations, or at least to crush many of them. But the global triumph of the West is not a global triumph of some form of universal reason. For Weber, precisely, history is the clash of civilizations, and the Huntingdon phrase is completely apt for Weber's more generalized interpretation of history. So when you trace out Weber's version of modernity, it's not surprising that although it leans heavily on Marx in some respects, it is in other fundamental respects quite divergent. And it's not surprising that you look at the history of modern social science, that as Marxism collapses, so people turn to Max Weber. That is, many people have made a shift from Marx to Weber. Or alternatively, they've made a shift from Marx, if I can put it this way, to Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault, as you'll know, famous more recent French thinker, but Foucault's themes are very much those of Weber. The themes of power, themes of domination, themes of a disciplinary society, and strong influence of a Nietzschean interpretation of history rather than a progressive interpretation of history. Turning from Marx to Foucault is quite close to turning from Marx to Weber, and it's a very prominent turn in modern social thought. To understand why, therefore, we have to look a bit at Weber's writings and see why they were so important, and try and just tease out their version of modernity, Weber's version of modernity, just see why it's so different from that of Marx. I happen to believe that both are flawed. That is, I'm not a believer that one can simply substitute Weber, or indeed Foucault, for Marx. I believe that we need to sustain some aspects of Marx's outlook, in fact, in the late modern world. But I'll be trying to show why that is so a bit later. Max Weber came from the first generation after Marx. Important to remember that. Remember, Marx lived 1818 to 1883, Weber 1864 1920, second generation, or the first generation after Marx. Weber therefore lived at the time at which Marxism was for the first time becoming a real political force in the world. Weber lived at a time and was strongly influenced by the rise of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, or SPD. The SPD became an explicitly Marxist party while Weber was still quite a young man, and became the first mass Marxist party in the West. It was the first of many. As I mentioned in the last lecture, the Labour Party in this country, one of the few political parties in the West not to have gone through a strong formative period in which it was, in some respects, a Marxist party. The influence of Marxism always much less in the British Labour Party than in most continental socialist parties. So Weber's life bears the impact not just of Marx's writings, but of the challenge of Marxism. The SPD and the other big socialist parties threw down a challenge to the existing order. That challenge was becoming very pronounced in Weber's time. Much of Weber's work, therefore, can be interpreted as a response to that challenge, and politically a liberal response to that challenge. Weber regarded himself for most of his life as a liberal. He was a strange kind of liberal because he, in a certain sense, also worshipped power, leadership, heroism. He wasn't a kind of English liberal. He was a liberal of a kind of nuanced and interesting kind. But he did, in terms of political theory, try to pioneer a liberal response to Marx. That produced a very different interpretation of modernity, and along the lines I just mentioned, from that suggested by Marx himself. Weber, let me just tell you a bit about Weber's life. Weber was very different from Marx, I think, as a personality. If you go back right to one of the first lectures I gave, Marx had this kind of dogged persistence. Although he seems to have some periods of self-doubt, Marx wasn't really a self-doubting person, I think. Marx was a driven person who knew what he wanted from the world and who knew what he wanted from himself. Max Weber wasn't like that at all. Max Weber didn't know what he wanted from himself. Max Weber was a deeply riven personality, I think. And this kind of emotional ambivalence in Weber's life is actually very important to the interpretation of modernity which he produced. Weber could never decide, essentially, whether he would be a man of action or a scholar pursuing contemplation in the ivory tower. Weber worshipped action heroes. Although he didn't completely approve of him, he was strongly influenced by Bismarck and by Bismarck's achievement in integrating Germany through the use of military power. The role of leadership is such an important thing in Weber's writings. Barely appears at all in Marx. Marx was never really interested in the phenomenon of leadership, but for Weber it's a really crucial thing. To some degree, you can trace this to the impact of Bismarck in German politics. A hero who, through blood and fire, as it were, produced the unification of a whole country. Weber, I think, wanted to be like that. He wanted to be a man of action. He wanted to play a part in politics. And he did play a part in politics, especially during the closing years of the war. Weber made many political speeches and seems to have played a part in drafting or influencing the Weimar Constitution. There also is an interesting controversy, which I'll describe in a subsequent lecture, linking Weber to the rise of Hitler and to the rise of Nazism in Germany, partly because of Weber's emphasis upon the leader. Weber wanted to be a leader. But basically, you know, like lots of academics, I won't mention anyone sitting here, he wasn't all that good at leadership and he wasn't all that good at practical action. He was more of a scholar, really. And much of his life was devoted, in fact, to scholarship. He was much better at scholarship than he was at leadership. But he could never really reconcile these two things. And I'd suggest to you that this comes out in Weber's writings as a dilemma of modernity, which links right back actually to Huntington and things I just started with. It's a dilemma of the relationship between reason and passion. Weber wanted the contemplative life of the rational scholar, but he also wanted full-blooded passion, as it were, in his life too. And he never really managed to reconcile those two things. According to him, the same thing is true of social life in general. No matter how much the claims of a civilization to reason, civilization and ethical ways of life, in the end for Weber, as for Nietzsche, are always driven by passion, or by passion and power. Passion, Weber thought, is never in the end reconcilable with reason. These are simply two different spheres of our lives. They are logically discrepant from one another, and they're historically discrepant in the sense in which there is a various sorts of clear-cut separations between the values of a civilization and its rational outlook on the world. Again, spend more time on that later because it's very interesting. In Weber's own personality, this crippled him. one of the things in which he was so different from Marx is that Weber found it impossible to generate a consistent attitude to life. And he was subject to recurrent depression. This was clinical depression for a whole year and a half of his life, around about the turn of the century. He was unable to do anything. He would simply sit, according to his wife, day after day, looking out the window, doing nothing. Was unable to study, unable to take part, certainly in politics, was kind of crippled by his own emotional difficulties. This also is really interesting because we're talking here about the just after the turn of the century. Before that time, Weber made his name, it's a very limited name, as a specialized economic historian and writer on the theory of law, jurisprudence. Weber was a legal scholar, and I hope it's of interest to some people here anyway, the theme of law is really, really basic to Weber's writings, and he had a lot of interesting things to say about sociology and philosophy of law. However, until the turn of the century, he was a relatively kind of concentrated, down-to-earth, empirical scholar, not very well known at all. Then he experienced this big depression, and as soon as he came out of this depression, he produced his masterwork. His masterwork, or his perhaps his most famous work anyway, which was first published in 1904 to 1905, was called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Protestant Ethic and Spirit of Capitalism, which first came out as two long journal articles. I think one could probably say this is the most famous work in the history of 20th century social science, The Protestant Ethic. I'll describe its themes a bit later. What it was an interpretation of the rise of modernity, the rise of the West, and the relationship between the West and religion. Weber had quite a different view of religion from that of Marx, even though there are some overlaps. This book was a subject of a major controversy as soon as it was published, and that controversy has not abated. Weber argued that religious ethics help explain why some societies are more compatible with capitalist economic growth than others. He tried to show that all economic development presumes a kind of ethical relationship to the world. And one reason why this work is still very much alive is that some people feel the same is still true today in a very different context in the East Asian economies, the successful Asian economies. Some people, well, many people, have applied Weberian arguments in trying to understand why these economies have been successful and other so-called developing economies have not. The reason, they say, following Weber, is there a certain ethical way of life associated perhaps particularly with Confucianism and other Eastern forms of ethical outlook on the world which promote a certain orientation conducive to economic success. More again on that later, since that debate is still very much with us. Weber again had interesting things to say about it. Now, at this time, well, even before this, Weber had to give up teaching in the university and never resumed a full-time academic career. I mean, he started off as a professor but never really could sustain the demands of teaching. Basically, he couldn't stand students. And well, that's not a dig. He just was unable to teach, really. He only came back to the university right at the end of his life. I'd just like to signal something quite interesting about this, probably familiar to some people here anyway, but a lot of the most interesting ideas in the history of both social and natural science are not produced within universities, even though universities are supposed to be the places where interesting ideas are produced. Many of the most significant figures in modern intellectual culture are people who were unable to hold down a full-time university job or in one way or another were alienated from universities. This was true of Marx, of course, it's true of Weber. It's true of Wittgenstein, it's true of so many other, it's true in the sciences of Einstein and so forth, true of so many other major intellectuals. Seems to be people who operate around the margins of conventional frameworks of knowledge and are perhaps even forced away from them, who produce the more revolutionary ideas. In Thomas Kuhn's book on the structure of scientific revolutions, if you remember, he quite often emphasizes this. It's people to some extent outside the academy or only linked in a conflictual way with the academy who produce the most revolutionary and interesting ideas. This was certainly true, I think, of Max Weber. Later in his life, Weber sort of entered this period of enormous productivity. I'll just mention some of his other most important writings. Incidentally, because social science tends to be a male-dominated endeavor, I think it's important to stress the significance of Weber's emotional, even sexual life to this productivity, because it's normally written out of intellectual history. In the early part of the First World War, following on from his depression, Weber seems to have undergone a sort of personality change. In the first part of his life, for example, he was in a very sexually repressive marriage, probably unconsummated marriage, with his wife Mariana. Around about the early period of the First World War, he came into contact with a range of free-thinking intellectuals who preached, among other things, sexual freedom, emotional freedom. Weber never sort of adopted these ideas, much too difficult for him, but he did actually have one or two affairs which have only recently come to light in very recent publications of Weber's letters. We only know about these through the publication of, or some of them, publication of the Max Weber collected edition, which is going on in Germany at the moment. Weber therefore seems to have this rich and complex emotional period of his life, and this seems to have set something free because it was a period of enormous intellectual productivity. Over the period from publication of the Protestant Ethic through to the end of the First World War, Weber produced the most amazing set of scholarly writings which probably anyone has ever produced in the social sciences. Weber had this quite incredible comparative knowledge of different civilizations and embarked on really extraordinary comparative project of comparing the West with the other major world civilizations. At the same time, he sought to systematize the social sciences and produced a diversity of methodological writings. He also continued with his political work and produced many interesting and very significant political writings too. Among the main things to be mentioned, Weber's master work, which you can put alongside Capital in the case of Marx, was Economy and Society. Or, as in the case of Capital or most volumes, this was not published in Weber's lifetime. He never completely finished it. It was published as a multi-volume work by his wife, Mariana, after Weber's death. It's an extremely comprehensive, encyclopedic account, really, of world history and of the social sciences in general. Very, very dense, difficult, but still utterly famous work. Weber also wrote on the religions and ethical outlooks of the major world civilizations, another project which he didn't completely finish. You can find these in the books called The Religion of China, perhaps still the most interesting one, I think, in some ways. Another volume called The Religion of India. Another one called Ancient Judaism, Weber unfortunately never, or barely started a projected volume precisely on the history of Islam and its relationship to other religions, particularly which came from the Near East. Weber wanted to contrast Islam and Christianity on the kind of long term, relating both back to the early history of Judaism, but never really completed that project. He also, of course, wanted to compare the Near Eastern religions to the Asian religions, and he discerned many very fundamental differences between these. If you want to read Weber. Everyone should have a look at Protestant Ethic. It's very short. It's got a lot of footnotes, but the actual text is very short. Some very famous passages in that to put alongside, like Marx's Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. Well worth a look as a classical source. But if you want to read Weber more generally, the best thing is to use one of the... Oh, sorry, this has gone off the bottom again. No, it hasn't. The readers I mentioned in the first lecture, Girth and Mills is a good one from Max Weber. From Max Weber. I'd recommend particularly in Girth and Mills' volume the two lectures which Weber gave when he briefly re-entered academic life towards the end of his own life. One of these are really brilliant things, I think. One of these is called Politics as a Vocation. Politics, vocation with an O. And some of you got a sense of humor anyway. Science as a Vocation, also with an O. They're two relatively short lectures reproduced in the Girth and Mills book. Now, Weber's starting point in his writings takes us back a bit to Marx. But Weber sought, for the reasons I've just indicated, to give a very different interpretation of what modernity is, of its relationship to capitalism, and its relationship to the other global civilizations. Marx only discussed one version of capitalism. He identified capitalism with simply the West. Weber had a rather different starting point, and it's a good way into his writings. Weber argues there have been different versions of capitalism at different points in history and in different contexts of various civilizations. First of all, you often find what Weber called mercantile capitalism. You often find what he sometimes called adventurer's capitalism too. If capitalism simply means the use of wealth to generate other wealth, Weber says this is quite common. You don't really have to explain it particularly because it happens a lot. Mercantile capitalism is wealth accumulated through trade and exchange. And Weber says there have been many cases throughout history in which merchants have prospered and have used exchange market relationships to do so. Second type of capitalism is associated with military power. Adventurous capitalism is capitalism based upon the use of military spoils to generate other military spoils. You build up a marauding army, you sort of rape and pillage, and you build up more financial power through that. You finance a bigger army, and off you go and you rape and pillage again. Pretty common through history. Now, Weber argues the basic mistake that Marx made was to suppose that there is a straightforward connection, particularly between mercantile capitalism and the origins of modern Western capitalism. This is not so, Weber says. This is not so. Western capitalism is very distinctive. It is not just a development of these pre-existing types, and it is unique. These are not unique, these types of capitalism. They are common. But what Weber often calls modern capitalism, or as he sometimes calls it, rational capitalism, only emerges in the West, has no historical antecedents, and therefore has to be explained. We have to ask, what was distinctive about the West that produced this particular form of capitalism? One of the big contrasts with it being that capitalism becomes a way of life. I'd like to stress this because it truly is basic. Mercantile capitalism, Weber quite correctly says, all the activities of princes were mainly marginal to the basic production system. In agrarian societies, you got merchants building out wealth. You know, they went out on their ships around the world and that kind of thing. But they were never the main producers by definition. In Western capitalism, capitalism is the basic production system. It is no longer a peripheral system. You can't underestimate the importance of this, particularly for us, who live in a global capitalist economy where capitalism is sweeping all before it. Weber argues there's never been a society before in history where capitalism has been the basic production system. This is very, very different from previous types of system. For it to be the basic type of production system, it must be regularized. That's what Weber means by calling modern capitalism rational capitalism. It's rational capitalism because it's a strongly routinized production system. Consider here anyone who's studying accounting. Weber thought that the invention of double entry accounting was a crucial breakthrough with the emergence of modern capitalism because it allows you to regularize profit and loss across long periods of time. Other civilizations, Weber says, did not have double entry bookkeeping. Double entry bookkeeping and modern accounting organizes capitalism across space and time. It's a space-time mechanism, if you like, in Weber's thinking. It is not, however, the causal origins of Western capitalism. Where do these causal origins lie? Now, Weber thought to investigate them, you have to see what is distinctive about the ethics, the moral outlook of Western capitalism or modern capitalism, and that moral outlook is sort of essential to the economic way of life, which rational capitalism is. Now, according to Weber, there are certain very peculiar features, moral features, of Western capitalism in its first emergence in round about the 17th century and going right through to our times. In previous types of society, Weber says, many people were interested in the pursuit of wealth. The merchants were, the rulers were. But they used this wealth to sustain a luxurious lifestyle. People were interested in the pursuit of wealth because they wanted to use that wealth to build big castles, to live in fancy houses, to have lots of luxury in their lives. They wanted the wealth to use it. Something very, very peculiar happens in modern capitalism. This connection is no longer there. With the advent of modern capitalism, you have among the early entrepreneurs and going on to some degree in the later history of capitalism, people who are very interested in the accumulation of wealth. They have a driving impetus to create wealth, but who do not use that wealth for their own personal lifestyle. Many of the early entrepreneurs, as Weber demonstrates in the first part of the Protestant ethic, therefore have a very different outlook on life from that characteristic of traditional capitalism. They want wealth, and wealth for them is something about the self, it's something about how the levels of achievement for them in the world, but they don't use this wealth, as all previous forms of capitalist have done, to follow a luxurious lifestyle. On the contrary, many of the early capitalists live a very frugal, self-denying lifestyle at the same time as they're driven to accumulate wealth. And I think all of us are a bit familiar with examples of this from later capitalist entrepreneurs. There's a famous example of Paul Getty, who supposedly made people make phone calls from his house using a slot machine, an ordinary telephone box out in the hallway. It wouldn't allow anyone to use his phone. He was a man who had, several thousand million pounds. The driven entrepreneur who wears a frayed jacket and cycles to work, a fairly familiar image. Weber thought most of the early entrepreneurs were like that. They were driven to accumulate wealth, but they were not interested in using that wealth for their own lifestyle. Why is that important? Well, it's economically essential, Weber says, as a causal feature in the origins of modern capitalism, because it provided what later economists would call for the takeoff period of capitalism, in which you need a lot of reinvestment of capital in order to get the whole system off the ground. The very thing that you could say has been happening in the Eastern economies over the last 20 or 30 years. You need people who are driven to create wealth, but who do not just dissipate that wealth, who invest and reinvest that wealth to accumulate, as it were, a new economic system, or to provide for the initial accumulation of capital, which makes for an overall economic system. So Weber's task in the Protestant ethic was to explain where this ethical lifestyle comes from. How could you get people who are so driven to create wealth, but who are not interested, not only not interested, but positively averse to using this wealth in their own lives? Weber found the answer to this puzzle in the influence of religion, and specifically in kind of sequence of sets of influences coming from Christianity and specific forms of Christianity, culminating in certain forms particularly influential in the 17th century. Let me just sketch this in, and I'll flesh it out in the next lecture next time. First of all, there is a general influence of Christianity lying at the background of the capitalist outlook on the world, a long-term influence, if you like. What is this? Well, Christianity, Weber says, in contrast to the Eastern religions, is what he calls a salvation religion. A salvation religion is one which generates enormous emotional tension in those who believe in it, because it has a notion of sin and it has a notion of redemption. We are all sinners, but Christ was there to redeem us, and we can redeem ourselves for our own activities. We can redeem ourselves in heaven. For Weber, this is not characteristic of the Eastern religions. The Eastern religions are not salvation religions. By and large, they don't have a notion of sin, and they don't have a notion of redemption. Weber thought this built up a kind of generalized emotional pressure in the West, a kind of driving force which could become, and did become later, linked to transforming the world. It's a kind of transformative religion, Christianity. It's not an adaptive religion. It insists we must master the world in serving God's purposes. Getting closer to the origins of capitalism, Protestantism, a contingent result of historical change, Weber argues, further shaped the ethical backdrop to what was to become a capitalistic outlook. Protestantism, Weber says, differed from Catholicism in that it introduces a much higher level of individualism into people's ethical outlook in the world. To put things crudely again, in Catholicism, you have a sin, atonement, redemption cycle. You do something you're not supposed to do, you go and see the priest absolves you, you say a few Hail Marys, you sin again, you go and see the priest again, to put things very crudely. For Weber, this, although it operates around a sin idea, it's a sort of cyclical notion. Protestantism, the Protestant does not have this mechanism, especially in the more austere forms of Protestantism. There is no one to intercede for you. There is no hierarchy to whom you can confess. You are therefore alone before God. And it's really worth stressing. Weber thought aloneness before God becomes a key moral feature, really, of the evolution of the West. Aloneness before God, responsibility to God, responsibility for one's own behavior in God's eyes. God is there watching you. You are responsible to him. For Weber, this explains so much about the subsequent history of individualism in the West. It doesn't yet explain the Protestant ethic. Protestantism also introduced the idea that I mentioned earlier in relation to Weber's lectures of the vocation. Luther had the idea that all believers work in a calling for the greater glory of God. A vocation is a calling. A calling, Weber thought. The idea of the calling became very important in the moral outlook of the early entrepreneurs. But it wasn't Protestantism which helped create capitalism primarily. It was above all Puritanism. And within the Puritan sects, there were two which were particularly causally significant in bringing about Western capitalism. One was Calvinism. Weber thought Calvinism, for reasons we'll look at in the next lecture, particularly shaped the attitudes of the early entrepreneurs. And this is still on the page. Methodism. Methodism, Weber thought, particularly shaped the attitudes of the emerging workforce or working people within capitalism. The early entrepreneurs, for reasons I have to explain next time, many of them were Calvinists. They derived their outlook on the world from the impact of the Calvinist ethic. The Calvinist ethic was the Protestant ethic. The Protestant ethic was in turn the spirit of capitalism, Weber says. But to establish a capitalist society, you also need a disciplined workforce. I mean, you need people who are innovative, dynamic, driven, but don't live in castles, who are prepared to reinvest their capital. Calvinism, for reasons I'll discuss in the next lecture, provided that. You also need a disciplined wage labor force. You need people who are prepared to work for 8 to 10 or more hours a day in a routine fashion without expecting anything apart from an economic reward. And Weber stresses peasant workforces were never like this. A peasant would only work until he or she fulfilled her traditional needs. He or she would then give up working for the day or the week or the month. We're so accustomed to working ourselves in occupation, we take routinized work for granted. Weber thought that Puritanism helped create the ethic of disciplined work. And he thought, I think most intriguingly of all, that we are all the inheritors today of the Puritan ethic. We live in a society dominated by work, dominated by the disciplines of work. Weber says we are all haunted by the ghost of Puritanism. We are all secular Puritans without knowing it in modern industrial civilization. Well, thanks for coming today. I think the lecture reverts to Wednesday next time. Thank you.